In today's episode,
all the anxiety of if I publish, who's gonna read it, what's the feedback gonna be. It's like that's probably the most important skill, actually, is like writing in public, is like going through this. I mean, dude, you do a lot of public stuff. It's like managing the emotion of like creating something and then distributing it. I think it's like it's 50-50. I don't know how you feel about it, but like creating the content and then actually putting it out there, they're equally important. And it's the putting it out there part that I had never really done and that I had to manage.
All right, welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi, and I have a very, very special guest today. My partner in crime on the NIA, Not Investment Advice podcast, Trung Phan. Trung, we're going to do the full intro on you in a second, but you're a writer at Bloomberg. People know you for your lowercase j journalist.
Creating with Workweek. An amazing B2B new media startup.
There we go. We're going to dig into that a little bit.
Listeners and viewers, for anybody that's listening, I guess most people here, Bilal is really struggling with the intro because he does a non-investment advice intros, and we're we've done 78 of them, and this guy can't, like, his brain wires are crossing. He doesn't know how to introduce me as like a non-co-host. It was like instinctive.
I literally went Creator Lab, and in my head I was like, no, it's Creator Lab. So anyway, so for people who don't listen to Not Investment Advice, you're missing out. It's been really popular. People loving the show. So you should obviously go and subscribe to Not Investment Advice if you're not already. But yeah, Trung, you and I have known each other for a few years by this point. We've just
probably
about
2 years,
A couple years. We've just about met in person now, which we finally got to hang out in New York
for a brief minute.
But we actually started the podcast together, and we basically talk every day by this point in our group chat with Jack. And that's happened over 2 years, all on the internet, which sounds really weird to people, but it kind of is weird, but it's also kind of
cool.
Dude,
it's not weird, man. Have you seen these? I mean, listen, we're not dating, but have you seen the dating stats? I think 50% of new relationships start on the internet. Like, dude, the internet's reality,
man.
You're
saying we met on Tinder. Is that what you're saying? Let's give people a little bit more of a background, though, because I think people have seen your name. They might have seen you on Twitter. You've got almost 500,000 followers on Twitter now, which we'll go into today. But let's talk a little bit about your background, because you've had quite a varied background. You grew up, you're Canadian, but your family from Vietnam, right? So
yes, sir.
When did they move there? How old were they when they got to the country?
Oh, man, do you want the OG story? I'll give you the TLDR.
We need to do the deep dive because we haven't done that before.
All right, so we're doing some how did the Phan family end up in Canada story. Okay, so my parents were born, call it mid-late 1940s, a bit older, 80 and 75, my dad and my mom respectively. So they're both young, in their 20s during the Vietnam War. In the South, we ain't commies. Let's draw the red line right there.
Let him know.
But my old man was a doctor during the war. He was a surgeon, and he actually has clippings from the Vietnam War. He's working with Australian doctors, and so the Australian media would write about his unit. And I mean, the shit's wild, dude. It's like he recently told me, because I just asked him for the first time. I'm 37. I didn't really ask him like how many bodies have you seen, and he's just like thousands, like literally thousands.
That's wild.
He was a surgeon during the war.
Yeah.
GIs, locals, just at any age group. So they went through some shit, and they got to North America, Canada, in very different paths. So my mom came from a fairly wealthy family, and they weren't able to take anything with them to Canada. She had relatives in Quebec, but they were able to leave the country on their own terms. So that's positive.
So wait, let's go. One quick question. You said she came from a wealthy family. What's that mean? Because we're talking, I'm Asian too, in a different part of Asia, Pakistan. So
crazy wealthy, but like you have to remember the wealth inequality.
Running the country wealthy or what?
No. not like Bill Gates of Vietnam wealthy, but like very well off. But it was all taken, so it didn't matter, right? It was by the time
that's why you had to emphasize the non-commie.
So my old man is a little bit different. His family's not necessarily wealthy, but they're wealthy in social capital, because my great grandfather is an animal in a good way. His name's Phan Boi Châu. Google that, you'll get a nice fat, long Wikipedia entry, but he was like the equivalent of...
How much
of
the Wikipedia did you write, Trunk?
Oh, no, I should update it to add me as a great-grandson, but I haven't touched that one.
Notable family members, yeah?
Well, the interesting thing is I don't even need to. It's like he's been covered by a lot of like professors throughout history in the last 50 years. Because what's interesting about him is he was an anti-French nationalist. So he's born in the 1860s, right about when France colonized Southeast Asia, or French Indochina, as they called it. And he, by the turn of the 20th century, so early 1900s, was like, I'm going to try to get the French out of this country. So he went to Japan, rising Asian power, tried to secure weapons, made a lot of ties with that country. But as we later found out in World War II, Japan wasn't interested in helping out other Asians. They were interested in taking over Asia. So it didn't super work out, but the TLDR is he did a lot of writing. So that's, you know, you mentioned writing that I do. My family definitely comes, especially on my dad's side, a history of writing. So like at a young age, I'll just tease it now, but like
this is great.
Always,
I didn't know
this.
Had
books
done
around the house. Yeah. And like my great-grandfather has some of the most important books in modern Vietnamese history in terms of nationalism and what it means to be Vietnamese. So I'll be honest, I haven't even read the books. Yeah. They're in Vietnamese. So
yeah,
like,
I was going to say, do you speak the language fluently? Can you read?
I have a couple of the books behind me, but let me actually show you something.
Let's do it.
Well, there it is. This is a headstone of my great-grandfather. Damn. There's something this big, massive, a full-size one, like weighs a couple tons in Hue. So that's central Vietnam. That's where his gravesite and his family home is and where my dad's family comes from. But dude, OG. And he's got a major street in every Vietnamese city. It's wild.
That's incredible. Man, so just to paint a picture for people, we've done our other podcast, No Investment Advice, for a year and a half. We've done like 75 episodes or whatever it is. I did not know. I knew that he was a G, but I didn't know that level.
And
in the background before, but I didn't know what it was.
Now you know, dude.
That's what we do. This is what happens in Creative Lab. We just all
We're getting to the story. So the writing. So that was always important. It's like, hey, listen, you come from somebody that was a very important writer and tried to make change from writing, right? I never thought about any of that, but like, I'm sure some of that was through osmosis, something that you think about, like,
yeah, of course,
like unconsciously, right?
So Trunk, wait, just for the people who don't know. So now you're writing. You write for Bloomberg. You write for yourself. You've got a newsletter. You write Workweek. Before that, you were with the Hustle newsletter. We've had Sam Parr on the show and Seth Smith, two of your old colleagues, on Creative Lab as well. So some people might have heard of that already. But you were writing a daily newsletter to a few million people, basically, right? That was your previous job before you left to do this stuff full time, which you're now doing. And then just to paint a quick picture, before that, you were working in the business world. You worked at Kenchu. I think there was another spot that you worked at. I can't remember the name now. And you've got an MBA, CFA. We make a lot of fun of that on the other show as well, because...
Well, technically, I don't have a CFA because I'll never pay the dues again.
Yeah. Exactly. But a lot of people who would have heard of you would have heard of you from Twitter. And that is
most likely
Trunk T fan on Twitter. Like I said, you've got almost 500,000 followers. That's coming up soon, which is exciting.
Are bots.
Yeah. Well, that's less than the rest of Twitter. So you're doing all right.
Yeah.
So that is on the Twitter side. We're going to go into like why you did that, why you kind of built that up. And you've basically been one of the fastest people I've seen to do that. I know you play it down a lot, but like you're kind of the king of like memes on Twitter, especially in our world, like tech Twitter, you know, finance Twitter as well. And you've kind of had this strategy of smart threads and dumb memes. I know you took out your bio recently. I just noticed that this morning when I was preparing for this. But that was honestly one of my favorite kind of like bios I've seen, because it like perfectly encapsulated what you do on there, right?
Well, let me address why it was taken out of the bio. So you're 100% right. Like getting from 0 to 500K in like, it was less than 2 years, but it was literally just, I mean, people at this point will know and probably be sick of threads, right? The reality is that they do work. Like Twitter wants you to stay on their platform. It all makes sense, right? If you're a Twitter product manager or you're a Twitter executive, it's like, you want people to stay on the platform. What's a great way to keep people on this platform? 20 tweet threads, right? So instead of having them jump out to an article. So the running joke is like people are turning Wikipedia articles into threads. It's like, that is happening. There are a lot of listicles that are happening. I've been guilty of some in the past. There's no question about it. I've been pretty thirsty on the growth front. Yeah. But what I will say, and why I guess it changed, I don't even know what it says now. I think it's writing about business or something. But I wanted to kind of more focus on the business side, on the framing. And also because I think for me, it's like a good thread. So my best threads, the ones that I like the most and I think are like, I can actually say I'm proud of writing, because there are some that I'm not very proud of writing, but there are some, like the threads I'm actually proud of writing, it's like they, first of all, they're about 1,000 words or 1,500 words. They're like long articles, and like they take as long as writing the actual article, if not longer, because you have to put everything within 280 characters. Every tweet for me has to stand on its own, as in if somebody just quote retweeted a single tweet from one of my threads, It would have to provide context and also make people want to read the rest. So like each tweet is like a total banger, right? So like that actually takes a lot of time. So
yeah, for sure.
Like that's, you know, like I guess a bit of a choose. I didn't want to just get clumped in with like these totally thirsty thread bros that are like,
The ones that are like, there's 8 billion people in the world, they all breathe oxygen, this is why you're breathing incorrectly.
Well, it's just like all this stuff that's just getting ridiculous, right? And it's working. Again, the Twitter is rewarding it, so, you know, more, I'm not even mad at it. It's like, people are doing what they're incentivized to do.
Well, I would argue though, since you said it's working, I will say, this kind of brings me onto a question for what you've been doing on it. It's working in like the basic sense of it's growing your follow account,
it's,
right?
Yeah, it's the most superficial. Okay, it's working in that more people are following you.
But and in terms of actually what I think is useful for Twitter or any platform, the reason I do long form is because what I care most about is actually like, honestly, the first thing is like having fun talking to people. That's the number one thing. But secondly, it's also like true, like kind of truth, right? Like this, the pursuit of truth, at least. It's nothing is actually like completely right and wrong necessarily, not to sound too dramatic, but like,
no, you're trying to learn something.
I'm
right?
trying to learn something genuinely, and I'm trying to like share good stuff, right? Like, and sometimes that's funny, yes, and sometimes it's useful. It just depends. And when someone writes a thread which says like, you're not using
here
Chrome
10
correctly,
Chrome plugins,
whatever,
right, it's like, yeah, okay, this is, I agree with you again, so like what is the end goal of why they're doing it?
Exactly, like, exactly.
And I'll say why I did it, why I started is like, so, well, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but I sold a comedy film 10 years ago. I thought I was going to be a comedy screenwriter. You mentioned the memes. I love memeing. They're way better memers than me, by the way, but like they don't do threads. So I'm kind of like cheating. So I get to grow the audience and like get to pump it into more people. But what I was going to say about the joking and the humor is, like the end goal for me, honestly, when I started seriously taking Twitter, maybe 18 months ago, was I literally just wanted more people to see jokes that I was doing, because I was making these jokes in like WhatsApp group chats with like 5 of my buddies, right? Yeah, and I'm like, I know these are fire jokes and I just want more people to see them. And I obviously had this like ambition 10 years ago of trying to be a comedy writer. So comedy is really important to me. And I'm like, okay, look at the algo. What's rewarding me? What's giving me followers? Okay, I'm going to do threads, but again, I want to do ones that I'm proud of. So I've totally gotten to a point now where I will only write a thread that I'm proud of. And these take me as long as writing one of my Bloomer pieces, if not longer. Probably longer, to be honest.
Yeah, because it's a very cliche saying by this point, but it's something like, if I had more time, I would have written you a short letter or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's actually Winston Churchill or someone, but but
cutting something down to concise is hard, right? It's hard.
It's really hard.
So I want to do something I'm proud of. So anything that I ever put out, I'm proud of. And I do think people appreciate this. And it actually is a good dichotomy with how much bullshit is actually on Twitter now, because it's just so obvious, right? It's just such a obvious like contrast between here's just a super thirsty thread that's gaming the algo, and here's something that this guy put 20 hours in. And yeah, it might not go as viral. I don't care. I've definitely gotten to the point where it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
And which
now
is great.
You've got to size where it's like, you're putting
it's
out
just the
stuff
size and the
like
type
it.
Of people that I think that are following it and happy to read what I want to do, right? It's like, again, it's free. If you don't like it, they don't care, right? It doesn't
Completely.
Bother me.
So let's talk a little bit about like jumping. We're going to go into like the deep dive on Twitter in a second, because I think I've heard you talk a little bit about it, but not in the detail that you'd normally get on like Creator Lab. So we're going to scratch beneath the surface in a minute. But like, let's talk about those big transition points, because I know, knowing you, you spent a bunch of time in Asia. You were actually living in Vietnam and yep. all over the spot there. I think you met your wife out there, moved back to North America with her. So you had a lot of fun. I'm sure you were doing some productive stuff, but maybe you were just backpacking.
No, I was being
stuff.
A total idiot.
Yeah,
was
okay, like... good. You were on Khao San Road.
Well, the equivalent. Well, I mean, Thailand is way more developed as a tourism. And you've been in the region, man. It's like,
yeah.
The thing about, if you haven't been to Southeast Asia, you might kind of box or like group those countries together. But Thailand's next level, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Bilal always jokes that they call me Fun Fact Fan on NIA, on Investment Advice, because I just have random facts about things. But Thailand's super interesting, because Thailand was the only Southeast Asian country that was never colonized. Basically, Burma, to the east, if you're looking at a map, was under British rule. And then French Indochina, which is Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, is on the other side of Thailand. So basically, the colonial power is just like, okay, we'll just leave Thailand be. We agree there'll be a buffer between our two colonial empires. And but what makes Thailand interesting is it became such a hub for this kind of tourism stuff because of the Vietnam War. That's where Khao San Road got a little bit sketchy with the GIs heading over to Bangkok.
So you spent a bunch of time out there. How old were you when you moved back to the state or the US or
no,
Canada?
I was born in Canada. So I never finished.
After that, I mean, after coming
back.
Okay.
So I went there when I was 22 and moved back when I was 27.
So you're there for 5 years, though. That's not like a 1 year gap year, as we call it.
5 years
is
a cutoff point, man. That's a running joke. Is like if you're an expat in Asia and you hit the 5 year mark and you stay, like you stay to year six, you're never leaving. Like that was a running joke. It's like that's a do or die. It's like that's the time.
You're the hardcore. Yeah, completely. And so like told me back going, you're 27. It's not like super old, right? Like it's not like you're coming back like 52. Not to say anyone's 52 is old, but you know, starting your
I mean, zero money, zero North American, like oh my, exactly. I mean, North American. I have a North American network for my college buddies, but like zero actual North American skills or reason for somebody to be like, oh yeah, let's just give this guy a bag of dough, right?
It's
like,
so what was your step coming back then? What was it like figuring out what to do? What did you do from there?
Well, so I convinced my now wife to leave a very lucrative corporate career. So in Asia, so not only was I leaving to go back to North America with like real no professional prospects, I asked my now wife and mother of our 4-year-old son to bounce from her career. So it was like, if you looked at it from like a balance sheet perspective, it was like a pretty devastating maneuver. But yeah, we were just like, okay, what can I do when I get back? Is the easiest transition was just student MBA. It's like, get yourself right in the job market, which is what I did. In hindsight, I would not do it again. We've talked about this before. Because this is the opportunity cost is massive, right? Forget about tuition. It's like you're throwing away, in my case, it's only a 15-month program, but you're still throwing away a year and a half of making money, and then you're paying them to teach you stuff that literally you don't even care about.
Yeah.
We talked about this on an NAA episode.
You can learn
like,
on a Wikipedia thread.
Yeah, it's so. Like, if it's not a top 20 program, it's probably not worth it. And then I end up working for a fintech company in product and research in 2015. Fortunately, we were acquired in 2018, which sent me back down the road of like, okay, you know, can kind of reassess the situation and think what I want to do moving forward. So that was like 2018 when I'm like, okay, so let me just take you up to that point. Is spent 5 years in Asia, kind of dicking around, sold a movie script, but never became a scriptwriter. So that skill wasn't super transferable for corporate America. But then now I'm trying to get in corporate America doing MBA, which in hindsight I never should have done. So, but by 2018, it had kind of all worked out.
And you didn't study, you studied like history or something before, right?
History.
Undergrad.
History, sociology.
So you probably could have got a job obviously with that. You went to a really good school in Canada, I know, and you probably could have got like a entry-level analyst role or whatever, research or something like that for sure, just being like a smart person. But the MBA probably helped like solidify some of that business kind of like chat, at least when you're in the job.
Well, the thing is, I had a CFA, right? I should have just gone with that.
That's true. Right? Yeah, okay.
I had
that's
studied the CFA
skill,
in Vietnam,
yeah.
And I'm just like, for to your point though, like the signaling angle, is like, yeah, I could have just gone and signaled that. But dude, if it's not a top 20, I strongly advise against MBA programs.
Yeah. And so just to fast forward ahead, you end up leaving, like, you know, Kenchu, whatever, you sold, the company got sold. Then you decide to go fully into writing. And like, yeah. This is kind of what's more interesting to me now, because now you've gone kind of independent. So you moved to The Hustle, which, you know, again, I think they had 1-2 million people on day's daily newsletter.
When I joined in April 2020, full time, yeah. I think it was like 1 million. Now it's doubled. Now it's doubled. In 2 years, it's gone
and
up.
And that
to
was
2 million.
During COVID. So you were already going to be working remotely, I guess, by this point. You were living in Boston.
Well,
I was looking for
something that was remote and that could actually, so we talked briefly again about this movie script and me wanting to be in comedy and entertainment and then spending, call it 5 or 6 or 7 years in corporate America. But like, I had two goals in like early 2019 before I'd fully left Kensho, which was acquired by S&P Global. So I was working for like a big Fortune 100 company, which was not my jam. And the consideration was pretty simple. It was like, I want to work remotely because I have a kid and I hate commuting, like literally hate it. This is pre-COVID. I'm like, I will never do that life that COVID has already kind of destroyed. But like, made that decision like a year before COVID hit. And I want to have the choice of living in America or Canada, and I want to be able to write, but it has to be comedic writing about business, because I think that's a good leverage point. So it's really combining my two previous careers. Yeah, it's like the perfect landing spot.
Yeah, that's a very interesting, because if people who don't know The Hustle, the whole kind of, I don't know what the right phrase is for this, but what made it stand out was, like,
it's humor.
It was like it's humor, and it was like your friend explaining stuff to you in simple terms
with jokes.
Certain voice. Yeah, exactly.
Business and tech in a certain voice. Yeah,
he's you know, a pretty funny guy as well in his own voice, but like eventually he had to like hire people who were better than him and that sort of stuff. So like, so yeah, you end up being there. You're writing. You're finally, you know, banging it out every day. You must have learned a bunch, I'm sure, like transitioning from just writing for yourself, but writing on deadline every single day. That's actually when we met, because you were writing, I think, for Trends as well at the time, which was one of the, like, the paid newsletter. Yeah. We ended up doing like a collaboration, like mini little segment in there about.
Well, I'll tell you what it is, actually. If you're talking about the learnings, this is the main learning that I had from that experience, is writing in public is, and dealing with all the anxiety of, if I publish, who's going to read it? What's the feedback going to be? It's like, that's like probably the most important skill, actually, is like writing in public, is like going through this. I mean, dude, you do a lot of public stuff. It's like managing the emotion of like creating something and then distributing it. I think it's like, it's 50-50. I don't know how you feel about it, but like, creating the content and then actually putting it out there, they're equally important. And
definitely,
it's the putting it out there part that I had never really done and that I had to manage.
And so, yeah, because if you compare that to your film script, that audience or whatever you want to call it, were
like three producers,
single digit people. Yeah, exactly.
That decide your fate after 2 years of rewrites, right? It's insane.
And that's really interesting, because one of my best friends, Hamza, he's probably might be listening to this. He's a, you know, proper actor. Like, he's been in a bunch of TV shows and movie and stuff like that. But he comes from like, you know, traditional like acting world, right? Like, he's trained, he went to acting school, did film for screen and all that sort of stuff. You know, that was the like name of the course. And so like, now him and his now wife, like, they create these like skits and like these kind of funny little shorts and stuff, which is really good. But their style of doing it is coming from that background of like, we're going to create something, we're going to pitch the BBC, we're going to pitch Channel 4 or whatever in the UK. And then someone's going to say, that was good, we're going to commission this, which like has value, right? Because lots of people still watch TV, but it's very different to...
You don't control anything. I mean, there's zero control.
And you're waiting for them, right? Like, you're waiting for them to say the permission to go and create something, a budget. Whereas now, and I think you've kind of had a foot in both of these worlds, the new version is, you know, we're talking about Mr. Beast, right? Like, dude is 12 years old, creating stuff on a crappy webcam, and then slowly becomes the biggest media property in the world, pretty much, with, I don't even know, is it, how many subscribers does he have now?
Over 100 million across everything.
Yeah, hundreds of millions, right? So, and he'll get one, I mean, his video for Squid Game got more views than Squid Game on Netflix, right?
It's insane.
Which again, is not to say Squid Game isn't 1,000 times better, right? But I'm just saying, the scale of it is kind of insane. So yeah, that But I want to go into what you said there, which was like the second part of like just putting stuff out there. Are you saying the mental part, right? Of basically saying like, put it out.
And that's the number one thing.
You're getting the feedback. Now someone hates this, or they're asking to change this. And oh no, they took it out of context. Now they're like trying to cancel
me. Well, actually, what's funny is that, I'll explain that. It's like you hit on certain parts of the anxiety, but, and I've said this on other podcasts, and I think I've even said it with us, is like when you have zero subscribers or zero people or zero audience, you're worried that no one will see it. So there's anxiety. When you have 500,000 or 400,000, 300,000, you have an audience now. But now you also have anxiety because everything you just said. Oh, somebody's going to take this out of context. Is somebody going to cancel me? Or people are going to hate this. So like, it does not matter like where you are as somebody that creates publicly, whether that's writing, creating a podcast or creating videos, is like you will have anxiety. And what the funny thing is, there's a complete opposite things now. I went from worrying that no one's going to see it to worrying that somebody wrong will see it. But it's not even a real worry. But this is what I'm trying to say is like, I manage those things. It's like, they don't bother me at all, right? It's like, I've always kind of been okay with that. Like, I did a decent amount, not like a ton, but like decent amount of public speaking before. I'm not afraid to put myself like in these type of situations. But that is what, when you said, hey, you must have learned a lot at the hustle. It's like, it's just publishing more out in public. It makes you work that muscle. And it made me realize, yeah, it doesn't bother me at all. So like, just, it's a good thing know that I can get that out of the way.
No, that's a good shout, man. Yeah, I didn't even think of it like that, but the way you put it makes a lot of sense, because the last thing I'll say is like, I can't speak from the writing as much, so I've done a little bit. More on like, let's say a YouTube video, right? Like a YouTube video, there's a public view count, right? So like that is different actually to podcast. When I launched CreatorLab, I've recorded, I think 10 or 12 episodes, and they were quite big people. So from day one, I had 3 big accounts on Twitter with a few million followers publish my stuff.
That's
so
huge.
Even if that translates to, you know, maybe a few thousand people listen, I can't remember in the beginning, but it was a big splash in the beginning, and you're starting from zero, and honestly no one can actually see the subscriber count on
that's
the podcast,
thing, right?
Right, which is actually kind of in a way it's a good and a bad thing, right? Because it means you don't get too distracted, or you don't get that anxiety, or there's a better word, anxiety is a part of it, but it's kind of like you're self-conscious about it, to be
you know
very
what
honest,
I think
you know?
the more I kind of create publicly, the more I do not want, quote unquote, the like number or the view number to dictate. And I know we talk about this with NIA. It's like this is why I always push on YouTube, right? Like I want that visible number. But let me explain to the listeners. So every weekend we release a not investment advice episode. And the right move to do if you want to grow a podcast is to plug it on Apple or Spotify, especially Apple, right? Because I think if you subscribe on Apple, you get the automatic download. Is that right?
Probably, yeah. It depends how the user set
the
up. But
like if you're to rank order where what you should link to in your tweet saying you did a new podcast, YouTube is probably last if you're not YouTube native, which we aren't. But that's where the view count number is, right? So like, you know, since day one, I've been pushing the YouTube link. But it actually doesn't make the most sense from the
like retention
our actual
or
podcast, our retention and our actual growth. But it's a pure vanity thing because I get to look at it. And but to your point, and we've talked about this a million times. Like you know YouTube well. It's like you should. I mean, you want YouTube to run or content on YouTube to run. It has to be YouTube native, right? It's like it's got to be like made for YouTube. And then you got to let the YouTube algorithm take over. Not
and
like
our joke is always in our group chat is like, this is what we're up against, boys. Yeah. And it's a screenshot of
the
Mr.
craziest
Beast, or the craziest thumbnail, and it's like 10-minute video.
And this is what you're going up against.
That's it. So the only thing I'd say, Trunk, one thing to say, just to clarify my point of view on it, because I know we talk about it on like over text and stuff, but I don't think necessarily directing people to YouTube is a bad thing. It's just more like, I don't think we're necessarily creating something, like you said, native for YouTube, where majority of people listening to long form, hour long stuff are listening in podcasts because it's long. Most people don't have YouTube
Premium.
Let me
rebuttal. I think YouTube's actually become the largest podcast platform.
They say that, and I spoke to them about that, but I think that's one of those things where when the scale of YouTube, when you cut the numbers, it is correct because you just the sheer volume
it's
of
too
people.
Big.
But if you're talking, if you surveyed even 100,000 people and said, oh, your podcast listeners, where do you listen to your stuff? Like a lot of them will say, I listen to clips on YouTube, or I sometimes watch a full episode. But the majority of people are listening with background play.
Like, how are they counting, right? It's like, how are they counting that?
Yeah.
Well, to your, yeah. I think to your point, I was just going to say this is like, yeah, podcasts, a lot of it's just background for people doing chores, driving, ETC, walking, to do some, tasks. But YouTube, if you're not paying for YouTube premium or whatever premium, the subscription is, you're going to hit up with ads, right? It's like having, and you can't even have, the podcast playing it with the lock screen on unless you have YouTube premium.
Yeah. You need premium for background.
So actually like, yeah, it's actually not the ideal podcast playing app, right? Cause obviously with Spotify and Apple, but look, let me circle. So the reason I bring all that up is this is I know that between us, our group, for non-investment advice, like I do kind of like, hey, let's push YouTube. Just like, look at the number go up. But like the more I do all this stuff is I feel more and more like that number is not giving me the right signal because again, it goes back to what we talked about with the threads. My most quote unquote viral threads are not necessarily my best ones, but my best ones do go viral. They're just not at the scale of some of the super Nova ones. And that one day feedback means less and less to me. And the reason I bring this up is like, I've been studying just a lot of like these wildly successful creatives. And man, this stuff like, we just keep on forgetting. We talked about it on our podcast. I forgot back from Spain. Seen a guy like Gaudi, the architect from Barcelona, who's, I got his book right here.
The Beautiful Cathedral, right?
The Beautiful Cathedral. It's just like this stuff is like, and again, this might be the wrong frame of how to approach life, but the stuff that matters and has long-lasting impact, it's not a Twitter thread, right? It's stuff that, and I'm not saying I'm building freaking the Sagrada Familia, but I think if I want to be a writer, there should be a North Star where I'm working towards, where I'm eventually going to be able to create a piece of something that will actually matter and really have long-lasting effect. And the way to do that is to write. I mean, ultimately, you have to write long form. It doesn't even have to be like a book or anything, but it's like you're going to have to put your thoughts into something where somebody has to sit down and wrestle with it for 30, 40, 45, an hour, right? And I've written things of that length, but I think that's a muscle that I'm interested in working more. And that muscle is not what translates on Twitter, where I spend most of my time.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. As you gear up for fall, you need the right people in your team to help your small business fire on all cylinders. LinkedIn Jobs is here to make it easy to find the people you want to talk to faster and for free. Here's how to get started. In a few minutes, create a free job post on LinkedIn Jobs and you'll tap into the world's largest professional network with over 30 million people in the UK. Then add your job and the purple hashtag hiring frame to your LinkedIn profile to spread the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people to hire. Simple tools like screening questions make it easy to focus on candidates with just the right skills and experience so you can quickly prioritize who you'd like to interview. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus leading competitors. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates you want to talk to faster and you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/creator. Again, that's linkedin.com/creator to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. This episode is sponsored by Just Works. If you're a small business, I'm sure you're looking for an easier way to onboard and manage remote employees. Just Works makes it easier for you to start, run, and grow a business. Let me tell you how Just Works can help your business. Just Works can relieve you of some of the admin work you don't love to do, things like running payroll, managing benefits, and figuring out state-by-state rules and regulations. JustWorks makes it simple to hire and manage remote employees across all 50 states. With JustWorks, you can onboard new employees with ease in an intuitive online platform, take the guesswork out of employment and tax regulations and requirements, access national health insurance plans so your employees can get coverage no matter where they live, get help setting up sick leave policies, and administering harassment and discrimination prevention trainings that comply with state and local requirements. Save hours on time tracking that syncs with payroll, plus access 24/7 expert support as well as certified HR consultants to get answers to your questions whenever you need them. Manage your remote team and run your business with confidence. Find out how JustWorks can help your business by going to justworks.com. That is justworks.com for more info. Now let's get straight back to the show. But it's interesting because I know just seeing, because a lot of people see you on the front side and they're like, oh, you're joking around, you're messing around, you're shit posting. And then once in a while they'll read the thread and you're like, oh, he really explained that really well and it was entertaining, but I actually learned something from it. But they don't know like how thoughtful you are about every detail of this, like specifically on Twitter, like even the dumb thread, smart threads, dumb memes, you know, summary. That is something like, I remember you talking to me about this once, was like your dad, or you were talking to your dad about this, but it was like when you think of friends at school, you said something like, oh, you don't like the showing off friend, like that person's always annoying, and you don't like the know-it-all, but the person who's funny, even when they're telling you something that is like new that you learn or whatever, you're just like, oh, they're always good to have around.
Yeah.
Is that something you consciously are thinking about, or is that just naturally like, you know, you like humor and you're a funny dude?
I wouldn't say it's like something I think about. What I would say is the things that I find like knee-jerk cringe, like you see stuff, like we always joke about LinkedIn, right? It's like you see like this people patting themselves on the back, or like posting photos of this achievement and that achievement. People are fine. People
or
do whatever they want.
Or crying,
right? That's
one.
The guy. But, yeah. But like, you know that gut feeling you get? You're like, oh, that cringe? I basically do that cringe test on myself. I'm like, if somebody else is doing this, would I probably roast them into oblivion? And like, yes, I would. So I'm like, I'm moving more and more away from that. And I'll be honest with you, like, I don't even care if I did that and got roasted, but I trust my kind of like roast radar. It's like, I'm like, ooh, that's not gonna sit well. And I think, actually, I'll tell you, you mentioned that guy. So there's a LinkedIn guy, for the listeners that don't know about the LinkedIn guy, there's a CEO of a social media company. He had to fire some people and made like this, a long LinkedIn post, and said it was the hardest thing he had to do. But then he finished the post with him, a crying picture of himself. So the criticism is that he made a turn firing other people into a story about himself, right? So it was just classic LinkedIn. But the reason I bring that LinkedIn story up is, yeah, the knee-jerk reaction, right, is like, this is idiotic. But when I was roasting that guy for it, I actually got a DM from somebody, and I did appreciate this DM. So this guy was getting piled on really hard. And Vice wrote a piece on him. We're talking probably millions of people saw this on Twitter, just getting roasted. And somebody just wrote to me, and he's like, man, Trung, like, you have a pretty big platform now. You don't need to like pile on to this guy, right? And he just said, just clearly some people in the world don't have great EQ. And he wrote to me, he's like, you strike me as somebody with good EQ, and maybe you shouldn't trash somebody that just has bad EQ. And I actually, that was probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm like, oh, this guy brings a good point. Is like, if I'm going to troll somebody, it's usually institutions, organizations, or just punch up, right? Like make a Jeff Bezos joke. Like you're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
But like this dude, who knows what his situation is. And, but the point I bring up is like, it's just the knee jerk. I bring all that up as a, when you ask me, am I trying to be like this individual that you want to hang around, or like in those group chats that doesn't make you cringe when they type something? I think I just have a natural, not a natural, it's like my personal gut reaction to a lot of things. It's like, I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I've just to comment on what you said there about the dude who, you know, did the crying face. I agree. Like, I think in hindsight, like, yeah, you don't want to pile on people in general. I also think sometimes when you put something out, you kind of got to live with the repercussions of
totally.
It, you know? And like, I'm sure, you know, it's not proportionate, right? Like, people are being dicks to him, and he's
well, what
like
he was saying, this guy
person,
was saying
right?
to me, is like, it's clear that this guy does not have the same EQ. So like, and then that to me was like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, fair
it was
enough.
Like, you should, I'm like, yeah, you're right.
It's just kind of, I guess, what you focus your energy on. Like, and I think, like, it's like you said, like, you've got a lot of people following you, and you can, you know, there's literally probably a million people might see what you write. Like, even with 500,000 followers,
a good distribution can definitely hit that. And it's like,
so like, that's a sizable amount of people to like be influencing, even with a small tweet, right? Or an idea in their head. And yeah, so if you don't want to use that to like pile on someone, that's a fair
I'm not saying
point.
People can't get roasted, right? Roasting, listen, because we always talk about Andrew Schultz, right? We
don't
get like, we're big fans. Like, he and I mean, I believe
humor is humor. Yeah,
I believe his stance. I know you're a big comedy guy. I agree with the stance of like, yeah, I'm not being offensive to one person, I'm being offensive to everyone, right?
Yeah, it's equal like, opportunity roasting,
equal,
basically.
Yeah, it's like South Park, right? They're equal opportunity offenders. I'm totally cool with that. What I am trying to do a little bit myself is take it away from the individuals. Like, I want to make fun of institutions, so I want to make fun of organizations, and I'm punching up. Nobody's going to be mad about punching up in like a tasteful way, like a tasteful in the sense of like, I don't want to make fun of people's personal lives and stuff like that, right? It's like that I'm mentally starting to draw lines is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And so, all right, so let's get back to what we were saying. So you worked at Hustle for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, I think it was. And in that time we started NIA together, you know, we're doing this every week. It kind of started as like a fun episode of Creator Lab. We did one as a test and then, well, actually, maybe we put it out straight away. We were going to do it as a test on Creator Lab. And then we just said, let's just keep it episode zero. Episode zero, which honestly was probably one of the best episodes. It's still like up there
because
we had a really deep conversation, though my mic was messed up. But so we've been doing that on the side. It's the pandemic. We're all at home. You're banging out these threads. At the time when we met, you probably had single digit thousands of followers.
No, not even. I was in the hundreds. Yeah.
You were just, you know, like just figuring out, like you weren't really going so hard. But there was at one point, I remember, I think it was the Hustle got acquired by HubSpot. And I remember speaking to you, and I think you were on like 5 or 6,000 followers. And I saw this thread you wrote. It was just popping off. And I was like retweeted it. And I was like, oh, I think you were trying to get to a certain target of followers or something by the end of the year. And I was like, oh man, this guy. And I remember DMing you saying like, man, you're on your way to like 50,000 followers or like 20,000 or something like that.
Dude, quit underestimating me, man.
Yeah, no, this is what I said. I said that too, because in my head, I'm like, you're going from 5,000 to 20 in like a few months. That's crazy. And you're like, yeah, man. And before, maybe I didn't even have a chance to say that, but I think you said, yeah, man, I'm like got my eyes on the 100 or 500, whatever it was. And yours, the number you said was just way bigger than I was even thinking. And I know you would like look to like someone like Pomp, who, you know, I'd put my episode out with him and he was already at like a million followers. And we were talking about that at the time. But I'm curious, like when you're setting kind of targets for yourself, when it comes to like literally a follower count, there's a good and bad part of this. Because someone who's not in this world might say, oh, that's kind of sad.
Like, well, yeah, it's a really dumb, I'll be honest with you. So let me explain that.
Like, yeah, go on.
It's a very superficial thing to put out, and I know that. But yeah, it's all it was. It was a number that I looked at the landscape. I'll tell you why in my head I'm like, okay, this is a game that can be played. Is like I was putting out content, and I consume a shit ton of content. I'm like, I think my content's just better. Like that's what it is. It was more native to the platform. It was better summarized, and there's humor in it. Listen, they're a really, really good creator. I'm not content with like writers and people on Twitter and making different type of content. But I just looked at for the niche that I was trying to do, business with humor. I'm like, I think this is something that is very winnable. That's what I was looking at. I'm like, I think this is a winnable game. And you mentioned it. We talked about it before. It's like, I could rattle off like the top business meme accounts, right? Like our boy Patel, like John Rich, Liquidity, the Jerome Powell, the fake Jerome Powell account. I gotta give a shout out to Kenneth Dredd, which
most
is
of them aren't using their own names, though.
Yeah, there are a lot. They're the only one that's using their name at the same level is so our boy Ramp is also on there, but the one that uses their name is like Doug Boomparth, right? And a great guy. But the thing is like nobody's doing the long form stuff because they probably feel it's actually cringe. So if you're talking about the cringe factor, they probably look at me doing it. Oh, this guy's being a little bit cringe, right? But like, again, I'm just saying, I'm trying to keep the bar fairly high. The difference though is it's under my name. And I was always willing to do that because something I will be doing, right? I'm going to be creating in some capacity, writing, podcasting, and doing that stuff for realistically the rest of my life in some capacity. And I just looked at it when you're mentioning around the, what called the 5,000. And again, it sounds so superficial, but it wasn't like that was a North Star for me. I was just like, this game is winnable. The score of this game right now, the way we're looking at it is the followers here. Other scores you could use is like newsletter subscribers or whatever. Again, podcast downloads. Those are different scores, right? The other element being that you want to curate also a good audience. And for me, that's all qualitative. It's like, I can't put numbers.
What do you and Jack say as the audience gets larger, what happens?
Yeah. Well, Jack says this. So now I mean, the audience gets dumber. Well, this is all it is because it's just pure numbers. Right?
Yeah.
It's, but I think just from, you know, some of the personal interactions I've had, DMs, chatting with people, just from creating in public is, I definitely have curated, not curated is such a dumb word. I've met people that I wouldn't have met otherwise. Curated is I'm curating my audience. Shut the fuck up, Trunk.
Yeah. All right. So, okay. And so I know I get the DMs with, you know, this person has followed you and, like, you know, there's some cool stuff. And I know even on my smaller scale from Create
Lab. Oh, yeah,
Lab
dude,
and,
you
and
have
stuff,
the, yeah.
No, but I just know, like, there is a thing. The reason I brought it up, it sounds stupid to people. Like, say you're listening to this and you're like, why does anyone care about follow count? So you said the honest thing, which is, yeah, it's a silly thing. It's an ego thing, whatever, like some words around that. But the truth is, it's not just that. It's also, there's a lot of benefit that comes
there's
from
correlation,
having,
right? So, like, here's exactly. A correlation. If I have 500,000 followers, the likelihood that somebody that I would like to know or meet and just have an interesting conversation with, that the likelihood is much higher at 500,000 yeah. followers than 0 followers that I can meet that individual, right?
And honestly, even just like, you want to write a book one day, you go
oh dude straight up I've been approached
000,
by every major publisher
already, exactly
yeah. all of them, they're just like, hey,
they would
because they know the game is social, right?
They
know how to break through
exactly. And so like that, it creates optionality for you. You can, you know, do many things. I know you've been approached by other people doing like TV stuff and stuff like that as well. So that does kind of bring me on to the two parts I want to hone in on before we jump into the little thing on Twitter in a second. You did talk about like that script you wrote a long, long time ago. And now I know in recent times you've been talking about turning that into a TV show. So like, what's the latest with that? And could you give a little background on what's going on?
Yeah. So I was living in Vietnam between 2008, 2012. And during that time I sold this comedy film script. It was a combination of The Fugitive meets Harold and Kumar set in Southeast Asia comedy. But movie never got made. However, the person that helped me make that film, so I had two co-writers, and we worked with a former Hollywood screenwriter. His name is Vincent Ngo, and he wrote a movie called Hancock, the Will Smith movie. He worked with Tony Scott, a bunch of other big Hollywood hitters for decades. He had helped us sell that film, write it and sell it. And then he's taken basically our story of living in Vietnam during that period, and together we put together a television show. And yeah, so I wrote about this a couple months ago, but there's a TV show, there's 10 episodes. We filmed the first 2 episodes of it, and we're figuring out the distribution now. It's like, do you go to the streamers to get them to acquire and finish out the season, or are we just going to finish it, the rest of it up? We're kind of going through a decision phase right now. We have to write. But the larger point about all that is, and we talked about this earlier, is no control. There's ultimately, the control is not in our hands, right? And if we choose for it to be in our hands, that's gonna be a longer slog, which is fine. A lot of people create their own content and go out there and do their own distribution, but the feedback loop's not nearly like what I'm doing right now, which is, you know, writing once a week, writing 2 or 3 things once a week, and then just being active online. So yeah, the television stuff is also a lot less appealing than it was 10 years ago, right? In the sense of, like, if 10 years ago, like, that hit, oh, it's amazing. But now it's like, there's so much out there. There's just so much content out there. And I know that Netflix is slowing down a bit on their spend, but the content spend's so massive, 10 billion plus a year. You're just so much competition on scripted that it's just not really to my advantage to spend a lot of my time in there.
And so I want to go into the kind of economics behind it a little bit. So 10 years ago when you sold it, I don't know, I wouldn't normally ask this on NIA, but you're on Create Lab, so I'm allowed to ask more detail than I normally do. Whatever you're happy to share, like, how much can you sell something like that for?
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about a film.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Versus like a TV show now. Like, what are you just trying to break even? Are you just trying to get it out there? Or are you actually trying to like make a big lump sum from it? Because then it brings up the question of, why don't you just go direct to people like you're doing with writing, right? And
well, let me answer that directly. It's like, why would I take my television show direct to people? You're not going to have the distribution to make the investment worth it, right? Like, yeah. I can invest 10 hours doing a thread and sending it out to people, and that's it. And it hits, it doesn't hit, whatever. Or send an article.
But thousands
or write,
of hours of recording,
yeah,
and budget.
Yeah, thousands,
and
the amount of money you're putting in, you're going to need the canon of like a massive streamer to really, that's not necessarily true, right? Like Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Insecure, these shows that were on HBO and FX, really successful. They started off as like kind of like YouTube shows or YouTube yeah. creator shows.
That's kind of what I was curious about, yeah, because there are, and I think just to add to your point there, Trung, there's also, I think straight up comedy, like we just mentioned Andrew Schultz before, but not a TV show where you've got, you know, hundreds of staff, but like he just did, and before him, Louis C.K., obviously, because he had to, sold directly to the audience, and they make their money from shows mostly anyway. But like there is, that's an early example of like, you know, low enough budget.
I would do that. To answer your question, I think what Andrew Schultz has done, where I was listening to him on the Colin Samir podcast, and he said that he wanted to make television shows as ammunition to get stand-up, to get himself an hour of stand-up. So like Netflix would be, oh wow, we really liked you in this TV show, we'll give an hour of stand-up. But then everything you mentioned, he's like, during the COVID, he's like, no, I'm just going to cut these insane Instagram vids with my team, build my own audience. I'm not going to use television to make me do stand-up. I'm just going to do what I wanted to do. And that's exactly what's happened, right? He just did what he wanted to do. So the right move for me, if I really wanted to pursue the television, is not like, hey, let's go make this. It's like, well, what is the end goal for me? We talked about, I want to make people laugh. So the end goal, the reality is I should be doing or trying what Andrew Schultz did, is cutting really sick videos and getting massive distribution on TikTok and YouTube Shorts. I'm just saying versus television, that is probably the correct move to do.
Yeah, it's an interesting example, because I think what you're finding is similar to you wanting to write a book, right? I'm not saying you want to do that, but let's say someone wants to write a book. Like my cousin just wrote a book, and the first thing they say to him is, how many people are following you on Twitter or on Instagram or whatever? And then they're like, okay, how are you going to promote this? Because it used to be they would actually help with a lot of that stuff. Now they might find you someone who might get you some press, but that's about it. And the press isn't even that deep anymore. They'll get a mention in an article which had a few thousand people read it versus...
Dude, exactly. Build your own distribution, right? It's like, that's what Andrew Schultz did. That's what he literally did. He's like, I'm not going to use TV as a way for me to get a stand-up special. I'm just going to do what I like, which is,
I think with him, he kind of had to, because he kind of got rejected by because of his style of comedy. And he did have real TV stuff before. But curious. Like, yeah, that was like writing specifically. To kind of come back to what we were talking about before, I'm curious, like, why you went after Twitter first in the first place. Like you said, you have done like public speaking. You now do a podcast with me and Jack. Was there a reason you did Twitter first? Is it just because you like writing and that was the easiest thing? Yeah, or what, was that something was like, you thought for?
It was, there was no analysis. I'm just like, okay, this is where writers go. I'm like, I'll just start here. That's it. And,
but then contrasting that with, I'm going to write on Twitter, to go a bit deeper into that, I'm not going to do a Substack from day one, let's say. Because now you have a Substack, you have your own email newsletter, but... What was there? Because you used to have a blog too, I guess. So was there like a decision between those two things as well?
No, it was like the Substack. Yeah, you're right. I had a blog before. And again, it was a distribution question. I worked on making content, but it was just shouting into a void. So building on Twitter is like, yeah, it's just, man, build your own distribution, right? It's like build a distribution and have a kind of goal in mind at the end. We talked about kind of the Thread Boys doing these Chrome plugin threads. But like, what is the end goal there, right? I don't know. I don't know what the end goal with that is. It's like, are you going to build this massive audience?
I think it's just the dopamine, bro.
Yeah, I think so too, right?
I think it's just like the clout and the... I mean, I don't know them. So maybe they've got a grand plan that they're going to turn that into something else later.
I think a big part of it is dopamine. I'll say that as a person that's kind of gone through it themselves. There's no question about it, right? It is very addictive.
Yeah.
I think with... I'm imagining your listeners, many of them will probably understand this, is Twitter is just awful at monetization, right? It's just like, you just have to, it's just a move, right? It's a standard move to get people off platform. So having newsletters is just the most natural thing. And I want to reemphasize, like, I want and I intend to be writing and making content for
a long time.
A long time, right? It's like,
if not forever.
Yeah, if not forever. So not everyone enjoys that. And I talked to a lot of people. They're like, hey, I'd love to do XYZ. And I'm like, do you enjoy it? And they're like, well, I'm not like a natural writer, or I want to do it for this other reason.
Purpose.
I'm like, that's not...
You're competing with people like you and others who really love doing it.
They just do it, so right? So to answer like the newsletter question is like, why Twitter's like, it's just writing. It's like, where can I write? And like, I've actually... I was going to bring this up on a podcast recording for NAA, but I've been doing LinkedIn more, and man, I make fun of LinkedIn so much, but I got to tell the listeners here, if you're already writing, you should go on LinkedIn. It depends though. The reason I say go on LinkedIn, so it's LinkedIn as a network is like 3 times the size of Twitter. Maybe not as like content native, like definitely people aren't going there for like breaking news, right? But people are on there for professional purposes. So crime bigger networks, picks. Yeah, bigger crime picks, bigger audience in Twitter. But there's a huge content deficit because nobody really wants to post because they don't want to like piss off their bosses or make their bosses think that they're trying to bounce, right? So there's not enough people making content for it. Yeah, so
they've also changed. I've seen that. I only saw this the other day because I turned off all my notifications because I was getting all these ridiculous requests, and they've actually made it like you can be a content creator on there, like you can change your profile type or something. So
yeah, you can.
And so that
follower first. So yeah, I'll say so. You don't have to do the connections anymore. People can just follow your account and look what you post. And
the organic reach is pretty good too, right?
Like yeah,
the
number of
people that see it is
it's all cross posting. I'm not like double posting from Twitter. But the reason I bring all this up is I've chosen, and my skill set is writing, and these are the platforms where I should write on. It's like we talk about this with non-investment advice. Should we do more TikTok? It's like sure we should. It's like. But like, that's
added
not
to a list of 10
yeah,
things.
It's added
that
to my list
doing,
of a million things I should be doing. And like, is that the audience that I actually want? Like, are they actually going to give a shit what I have to say on my
newsletter?
That's
also a great point. Yeah. Cause that's kind of what it, like you like none of this is right and wrong. Right. Like, but the people I know a couple of people have really done really well on TikTok. They've got that, you know, nice follow account. They've got the organic reach. A lot of people will see this stuff, but then a lot of them are saying, oh, now I want to take them somewhere else.
And exactly.
And then if that's the end goal, that's why honestly, when I started the podcast, that I literally focused on how do I drive podcast downloads and subscribers. That was my number one thing. And I didn't do it perfectly, but that was what I cared about because I wanted more people to listen to long form conversations that I wanted to put out. And so not to say that if I'd written on Twitter, like if I'd done all these other things, that would have obviously helped. But it was just like a distraction from the other stuff I was already doing. And just now, like to be completely frank and honest about, like I know other people's podcast numbers who have massive Twitter following, including you and Jack, because I do both the podcasts, right? So I can compare and I can see actually what I was doing with a much smaller audience on Twitter and elsewhere is still as big.
Yeah, you
as
focus
people who
on the
massive
medium, right? You focus on the
exactly.
So just to answer your original question is like, you know, why Twitter? It's just, again, it's writing first. That's just where it's meant to be. And we shared this tweet amongst us, which was funny because it's like Substack gross revenue last year is 100 million. OnlyFans gross revenue is 5 billion, right? It's like, there are like for all
that's
like
the real creator economy there,
yeah,
bro.
But that's what I mean is like for all this, there just aren't that many people making like insane livings. Not necessarily that's a reason, but like as newsletter writers or as people that write, that want to write. But I think the model like of, you know, be a free agent, don't tie yourself to these older institutions, get good at Twitter, understand how to drive to newsletters is like, but honestly do it because you want to do it, right? It's like,
yeah,
it goes back to these Chrome plugin thread boys. It's like, why are you doing it? What is the ultimate reason you're doing it?
And so the last kind of thing to wrap us up is if you were starting today again from scratch, because I know you did this a few years ago, with your goals, because obviously this is not advice to everyone in the world. It's for someone like you who actually likes writing, who wants to create some independence. Let's say they were in a job like you were, but you want to give yourself optionality to do something. Is there anything you'd do differently now, like in the age of 2022 with the way the algorithms are and the way the platforms
are? I would have started the email list way earlier. So
okay, that's what every single person says, yeah.
Yeah. Do a lot of your hosts say
that
or just in general?
A lot of people have said, I wish I did it earlier, because they all realize how little control they have of the algorithm.
Yeah.
And when it changes, you get kind of hit.
Totally. I would say I'm on board with it. Anybody else you've had that said that is like, start, build, and okay, have a good reason to do it and intend to do it. Don't just do it because everybody else is doing it. That's the dumbest reason to do anything. But if you want to create content, right, and you know, you enjoy it, you foresee yourself doing it for a long time, definitely start the newsletter. Twitter is a little bit tougher to break into now, especially with the Thread Boy activity happening, but that's why I think the LinkedIn arbitrage is real. It took me forever to get pulled into it, but this is the real LinkedIn arbitrage, is if you actually don't give a shit and you can write freely, because that is such a rare commodity on that platform. That is actually where the real arbitrage is for audience building. And I hate the word audience building. It's the worst thing ever, the term. What I say is that there's a couple other things that I put out there. You should just write, period. If it doesn't matter what industry you're working in, you should write. Having a single anchor piece is huge. It's like, sit down. Can you sit down for 20, 30 hours about a topic you're really passionate about, or maybe not even passionate, but like, a shit ton about. So there's two ways to do it. It's like two easy pieces of content that anyone can do right now as an anchor piece. And what I mean by anchor piece is something you could share with anybody, or it could be pinned to your profile, or be something that you get remembered for, right? Come top of mind for something. Let's just say randomly, like you're big into nuclear energy. You could write a 5,000 word on idea on, like, if you are starting a nuclear energy startup, this is how I would do it, and here are my bona fides. Like, that piece can get shared, and you have no idea who's going to read that. But that this is nuclear energy essay guy, right? And or gal. So that piece of content is something that you can always be sharing. If you meet somebody, it's like
evergreen. Does it need to be evergreen normally as well?
Evergreen's obviously the best. But the reason I say the anchor piece is people see other individuals online so quickly, right? And our attention spans are so short. You have to give people something to latch onto. It's like, what is this person doing? What is their interest? And if you can get somebody to sit down for a couple thousand words, something you've really put some good research into and that you believe and you've published out there, you can start attracting people just from a single piece of content. I think everybody should have one of those things. If, again, the premise being that they want to be doing this, but if you want to be writing, creating, it's always good to have an anchor piece of something.
But 20, 30 hours, that's a great time frame to, I mean, that's probably what you spent on doing some of your biggest pieces. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you want a good anchor piece. And the other thing I'd say is, even if you are in a job, so you mentioned before, I was working corporate America, making the transition, be pseudonymous, right? We've talked about this NIA, like create pseudonymously. There are certain industries where you're pseudonymous.
For people who don't know that phrase as much, there's anonymous, there's people using their real names, and in between is pseudonymous, right?
So this is the difference. Anonymous is just
known for something.
Yeah, they have a persistent reputation. That's what Balaji calls it. They have a persistent reputation. So if you're pseudonymous, you're not giving away your real identity, but you have an online identity, and that online identity builds a reputation. So let's say that your personality is, just call it whatever, Gaudi X is your online name, right? And you write 100 pieces of content, and people love you and come to you for this type of content. Well, you can lose that reputation by doing something really dumb, right? So, but the whole point of having the pseudonymous identity and writing is you get to share expertise. And that's where we talk about the optionality comes later. It's like, if you want to jump into doing something else, you've have this now, right? And it's like, hey, you were doing a blog for Arsenal, right? It's like, you did that probably under your name, but like, if you had just had that.
But for a long time, it was like 2004 originally. So it was like, there was not really the same social media that you have now. So
totally.
Even if people saw my name, there was no like click and see his picture.
Linking it,
that, interestingly, it kind of gives you that mental freedom a bit to be like, in a world where you're worried, let's just be honest, like you are worried about what your friends think and people
totally.
Think you shouldn't, but like that is, we're human.
Reality, so anxiety we're talking about.
Exactly. But when you put it out, and you like the way I was putting it out, no one I knew was reading it. So that's actually quite a nice thing to have in your head of like, no one's judging me for this. I'm just going to put out. Honestly, now I look back at it and I'm like, oh my God, I had to take a bunch of it down because I was like, is terrible. I mean, it was terrible writing. Like, I was 16, man. I was like, but I mean, not that I'm not proud of what it was. It's just now, because I was going to potentially relaunch it. And for that reason, I kind of need to I probably need to create those, the anchor piece, like you said, because the interesting with football a lot of it is about what's happening right now, and it's out of date.
But
tomorrow,
you can write some insane arsenal, like exactly, these are the three most like
profile
events
of Arsene Wenger. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm probably gonna do one on scouting, like how scouting works, and I'm interviewing a few people who do that.
Oh, so amazing!
Yeah, I don't know if I'm actually gonna do it, but it's been on my head for a long time, and I can't need to commit.
You know what
to
I mean?
Not.
You're thinking about the anchor piece, like you already thought about that. You know what I mean? It's like something you can share with people that just express your interest quickly, and it sits there. It's just working for you at
that's
all times.
Yeah, no, that's a good. I didn't think of it like that. And I know we're running out of time. I did want to ask you the last question, because you were talking about the anchor piece. It was really, actually a really good frame to think of that. A lot of people say, look at you, and you just knowing you, like you taking insane amounts of information. And to be fair, so do I. But you read a lot more than I do. I listen to like,
oh yeah, you listen 12 hours a day, bro.
Right, so because of that, like we're taking in different stuff, but all together we end up finding cool stuff. Now, like we talked about this a little bit on NI with Jack, where we talked about broad versus deep. And your approach, from what I can see from the outside, is you do actually cover quite a lot of broad stuff in terms of you've got the lens of business, but you've also got this history kind of background and angle. And then you basically explore your curiosity and you like write about whatever you want. Like last week, it was about AI and art. And I forgot where else it was, but something to do with art. And then a week before that, it was about crypto and something else, you know? So there is a way to do both. And someone like Jack has done the opposite, where he's kind of like really quite specialized. And even though he knows about a lot of different things, his approach is like, I'm going to say the same thing 700 different times. And that works too. Like as it relates to like finding ideas to write about though. So forget podcasts, YouTube, everything, just specifically writing. Let's say someone like me, just to take it away from yourself, you know me a decent amount. If I was trying to figure out and say, I want to write, like I actually do love writing and I've written for a long time in different ways too. And I've kind of fallen out of the habit and I want to kind of do more of it. How would you advise someone like me to find the things I want to actually write about?
You know what? I'm going to bring YouTube into it. So
go on.
I'll bring two, just call it like content. Some people call it intuition pumps. It's like, how do you get ideas flowing, right?
Yeah.
Is YouTube's actually a great one. So anything that you would search on, let's just talk about your scouting, your Arsenal scouting.
Yeah.
I bet if you Googled Arsenal scouting, you would get a dozen really high quality video essays. But here's the beauty. They're going to keep feeding you related content or ones that are within the universe of interest or the people have expressed. So dude, I've let the YouTube rabbit hole guide me into, no, I'm actually dead serious.
Yeah,
it's, like,
yeah, it's a good point. I didn't think
a
of
lot
that.
Of different, I'll give you the most, the latest one I've done. I've just gone crazy on art history. I never had an interest in art history, never cared about it. But then one day I was reading something about Mona Lisa and then found out that why the Mona Lisa was famous. It had nothing to do with the actual quality of the artwork. It was stolen in 1912. And the search for the Mona Lisa took 2 years. And over that 2 year span, the entire world basically saw pictures of the Mona Lisa in newspapers. Like, where's the Mona Lisa? So like the fame of the Mona Lisa happened because of a robbery. Not to say it's not an incredible piece of artwork.
Yeah,
but
that's the story that popped
Da Vinci has had comparable, if not better, artwork. Other artists have had better artwork, but Mona Lisa is the most famous piece of art in the world because it was stolen in 1912. So I found this out. I read about it. And then instead of Googling it, I did a YouTube search about it. And then YouTube fed me like 20 straight videos and it just took me down a massive art history rabbit hole. So I'm learning about Picasso, I'm learning about Van Gogh, I'm learning about Michelangelo. I had no interest before. I had nowhere to guide me. The algorithm took me and it didn't make me an extremist. No,
okay,
just, that's a joke,
that,
right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I think that I actually think that is something that's like
a great point.
Here's the thing, man, you put on these videos and like a good YouTube video essay, about 10 minutes, right? Because you know the rule. They want you to watch minimum 10 minutes watch time for the algorithm boost. But you turn on the 2X, you watch that thing in 5 minutes, you're going to get fed 10 videos that people have spent 40, 50 hours compressing information into with the visuals, which is a huge learning aid. and you're gonna walk out of an hour of a YouTube rabbit hole with 20 different writing ideas.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah, I love that. All right. So follow. Yeah, I like that. That's quite a specific thing as well. Yeah, because I was thinking that the one thing I've had is where I listen to so many different things and I'm interested in lots of different things. And then when you go to actually creating stuff, you kind of end up wanting to cluster around something.
Well, podcast is hard, right? And you told me that you have the app. Is it called Snipped?
Snipped,
where you can,
yeah.
Yeah, where you can snip parts of podcasts. It's just not the same with YouTube, right? Because you just have...
You can't
if YouTube sends you 20 down a 20 video rabbit hole, you have your watch history. There's 20 articles right there. There's like 20 ideas that you can write
that's
about.
That's a great point. All right, Trung, thanks again for being on the show, man. We'll have to do this again.
In fact, we're about to
do it in a second because we're about to record NIA episode 2. Thanks for being on the show. People should go check out your newsletter. You're obviously on Trung T Fan on Twitter. Where can people sign up for the newsletter as well?
Everything's on my the Twitter.
Right, Trung T Fan. I'll link it out to it in this. Thanks for coming
on,
man.
Come on, listen to NIA, people.
That's the main thing. Make sure you subscribe to that as well. And thanks for going deep on that, man. I didn't actually know a bunch of the stuff you talked about today, so that was great. All right, and thanks again for being here, and we'll see you on the next one. All right, cheers.
Awesome.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.